She was not supposed to reign. She was a woman and therefore was not supposed to be sitting on the English throne.
I think what's interesting about Elizabeth is that she manages to be so successful in an extremely male environment. There's no other woman who really has much political power, really, in the whole century.
Queen Elizabeth I made a great deal out of her being the Virgin Queen, but Queen Victoria passed through all of the conventional roles of a woman.
You may know the apocryphal story of Sir Walter Raleigh laying down his cloak so Queen Elizabeth I could cross the road, and Queen Victoria's famous, "We are not amused" countenance in photographs. Elizabeth reigned for 44 years, and Victoria ruled for 64. Elizabeth was classically educated and wrote poetry herself, and Victoria left over 90 volumes of her journal, and each presided over a period of major literary development in England. I'm Sally Plaxton. On this edition of What's the Word, we'll look at how these two women influenced not only the politics and mores of their times, but also the literature. Elizabeth never married, and Catherine Eisenman Moss looks at how Elizabeth's status as the Virgin Queen was depicted in literature and came to symbolize England itself. Maureen Quilligan shares some images of Elizabeth from the works of such writers as William Shakespeare and poet Anne Bradstreet. And Adrian Munich dispels the myth that Queen Victoria was not amused and tells how instead her image was found in Victorian works that ranged from Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado to the broadside ballads sold on the streets of London. So spend a half hour with royalty and join us on this edition of What's the Word? Elizabeth and Victoria.
Elizabeth and her court, there are just really a lot of fascinating personalities and personality conflicts there.
Catherine Eisenman Moss teaches English at the University of Virginia.
There's a tremendous number of works of literature and operas and so on written about, for instance, Elizabeth's conflicts with Mary Queen of Scots, or Elizabeth and her favorites, the Earl of Leicester and later the Earl of Essex.
In the Donizetti opera, Maria Stuarda, Elizabeth, known for not being able to make up her mind and often using it as a political delaying tactic, debates about whether to accept a marriage proposal from the King of France. Elizabeth came to power in 1558 at the age of 25 and ruled until her death in 1603. But despite expectations that she would marry, she never did.
This created a situation where England could really steer its own course. She was not dependent on anyone, and neither was her country. And I think you see that sense of English, sort of proud English isolation, reflected in a lot of the literature of the period. You see that in Shakespeare's description of England in Richard II, when he says, "This fortress built by nature for herself against infection and the hand of war, this precious stone set in the silver sea, which serves it in the office of a wall or as a moat defensive to a house." That's a description of England as an island set apart, inviolable, impenetrable by foreign invasion. And I think that's a fairly new conception of England in that period. I think it comes about by analogy with the Queen's virginal body, that people think of her as intact, as somehow untouchable, and they hope that England will be the same way, that it can steer its own course, that it can be its own country and not a satellite of one of the other great European powers.
Edmund Spenser wrote about Elizabeth in his poem, The Faerie Queen, one of the most important epics of the day. But as Moss points out, writers had to be careful not to offend the queen, and therefore they used certain literary devices.
One tactic is to write allegorically, but to write allegorically in a way that everyone knows what you're referring to, but to make the allegory slippery enough that you can always disclaim the allegory under pressure. That's what Spenser does in The Faerie Queen, where he writes about not England. This is not England. This is fairyland. It gives your work deniability. But there's another way in which the queen's kind of power tied into literary traditions in a kind of interesting way. And that's that there's a long tradition of writing love poetry from a man of lower rank to a woman who's saying no of higher rank.
Betty Davis played Elizabeth in the film The Private Lives of Elizabeth and Essex. Glenda Jackson portrayed her on the 1971 BBC series Elizabeth R. And there have, of course, been countless biographies.
I've always been a fan of Elizabeth, ever since I was a little girl. I remember reading the landmark biography of Elizabeth I and thinking she sounded just great. And I continue to think so. There's a scholarly biography by John Neal, but there's thousands of popular biographies of Elizabeth.
Indeed, although people were eager for a change at the time of her death in 1603, as soon as James came to the throne, a kind of cult of Elizabeth was rebuilt.
This is helped by her first major biographer, William Camden, who wrote a long biography of Elizabeth that continues to be a major source for 20th century biographers, and which has really, I think, helped condition the favorable reading of Elizabeth that you get in so many modern accounts of her.
An excerpt from William Camden's The History of the Most Renowned and Victorious Princess, Elizabeth, Late Queen of England.
Queen Elizabeth, being a virgin of a manly courage, professed that she was an absolute free princess to manage her actions by herself or her ministers. And though in the reign of her sister nothing was done without consulting the Spaniard, yet her will was that this matter should be treated and agreed upon betwixt her commissioners and the commissioners of France, without acquainting the Spaniard, not in an obscure place, but at the castle of Cambrai, which is not far from the city of Cambrai.
An excerpt from William Camden's History of Queen Elizabeth.
I think what's interesting about Elizabeth is that she manages to be so successful in an extremely male environment. There's no other woman who really has much political power, really, in the whole century.
I'm Sally Plaxton, and you're listening to What's the Word? Elizabeth and Victoria.
She was not supposed to reign. She was a woman and therefore was not supposed to be sitting on the English throne.
Maureen Quilligan teaches English at the University of Pennsylvania and specializes in non-dramatic Renaissance literature. She's also talking about Queen Elizabeth I, and she believes that today, literary scholarship is shedding new light on the Virgin Queen of Renaissance England.
Contemporary literary scholarship is viewing her in a new way because they have seen how incredibly important the anomaly of her gender is to what we think of as being Elizabethan literature. It is indeed marked very much by her personality and, again, the oddity of her gender being a woman on the throne.
Elizabeth influenced the literary world of her day both directly and indirectly. She kept the theaters open when puritanical city fathers wanted to shut them down. And she was an indirect influence because her image became so important in the works of the day. This is reflected in Edmund Spenser's epic poem, The Faerie Queen, a work which has influenced poets over the centuries and continues to do so. An epic poem traditionally celebrates the exploits and achievements of a great hero. Spenser's Faerie Queen, which he presented to Elizabeth at court, gives us, along with male heroes, female figures in central heroic roles.
And here Spenser is introducing to his queen, as first reader, a book, The Legend of Britomart, was a female warrior, who is the titular knight who represents the virtue of chastity, because, of course, Elizabeth was the virgin queen.
In the poem, he writes about two female figures, Belphoebe and Gloriana.
So Belphoebe is the woman figure in whom Spenser represents and talks about Elizabeth's female chastity, the allure of her very virginity. And in Gloriana, who is the fairy queen, so the whole poem is named for Elizabeth. Gloriana is the ruler, whom in fact we never get to see because Spenser didn't finish the poem. But this is a general sense of how much Elizabeth was a cynosure of her culture.
The term Elizabethan drama came to refer not only to the works of Shakespeare and others of the day, but to the works of playwrights who came later as well. But references to Queen Elizabeth certainly figured in the work of William Shakespeare.
Shakespeare did write directly to her, we think, in Midsummer Night's Dream, probably around 1596. Spenser published the first installment of The Faerie Queen in 1590, so about 6 years later. We have Midsummer Night's Dream by Shakespeare that features Titania, who is a fairy queen. And so with this reference, I think quite self-consciously, to Spenser's production, it is not surprising that we should find right smack dab in the middle of Midsummer Night's Dream a reference to Elizabeth.
It comes when Oberon, king of fairies, explains to Puck where he can find a particular flower, whose juice, Shakespeare tells us, when laid on sleeping eyelids, will make a man or woman madly dote upon the next live creature that it sees.
He's going to take the juice of the flower and squeeze it into the lover's eyes and make everyone fall in love with the proper people.
Shakespeare gives Oberon these words to describe it.
That very time I saw, but thou couldst not, flying between the cold moon and the earth, Cupid, all armed. A certain aim he took at a fair vestal throned by the west, and loosed his love shaft smartly from his bow, as it should pierce 100,000 hearts. But I might see young Cupid's fiery shaft quenched in the chaste beams of the watery moon, and the imperial votress pass it on in maiden meditation fancy-free. Yet marked I where the bolt of Cupid fell. It fell upon a little western flower, before milk-white, now purple with love's wound, and maidens call it love in idleness.
From Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, Maureen Quilligan.
This is, of course, a pansy, but what a lot of scholars have agreed to see here, Louis Montrose is the critic who's most persuasively and first made this argument, that what Shakespeare is doing is taking this reference to Queen Elizabeth's virginity, she is the imperial votress, throned in the west, who quenches the fiery shaft of Cupid and is able to pass on in maiden meditation, fancy-free, she's not made to fall in love by Cupid, so that this quenched arrow falls on the pansy and therefore gives it its remarkable erotic power. Louis Montrose argues that this is a way of setting up Elizabeth's virginity as absolutely and utterly unique, not something that would be shared by other women in Elizabethan society, and therefore the power that Elizabeth wields stays separate and unique to her.
Much of Elizabethan culture, particularly in the theater, is trying to figure out the relationship between the genders.
Shakespeare's theater, Ben Jonson's theater, everybody's theater at this time, Elizabethan and Tudor and Stuart theater, before the theaters were closed during the Commonwealth period in the middle of the 17th century, was an all-male theater. There were no female actresses. But what is remarkable about this theater, this all-male theater, is that these men got dressed up as women and tried to figure out what the relations between the sexes were all about. Because the culture was trying to figure out exactly what it meant to have a woman on the throne, it sort of threw a lot of rules up for grabs.
Elizabeth is also present in the works of female writers of the day. Mary Sidney, sister of poet and courtier Sir Philip Sidney, wrote a poem when she dedicated and gave to Elizabeth a copy of the Psalms, which she had translated with her brother. She wrote to the queen,
"What heavenly powers the highest throne assigned thee goodness suiting that degree, and by thy strength thy burden so designed, to others' toil is exercise to thee."
all the male poets are talking about her chastity is what makes her so unusual. She's so perfect. She's so beautiful. She's so this, she's so that. Mary Sidney doesn't say anything about her chastity, doesn't say anything about her beauty. What she says is, you're so much better at getting the job done than anybody else.
Elizabeth's impact spread to the New World as well, in the work of an important 17th century poet, Anne Bradstreet. Bradstreet was born in England and came to America in 1630. Like other women writers of the time, she used Elizabeth's example to show what women were capable of.
There was a whole argument about the nature of women, that Elizabeth was drawn in to play her part, and here you have Anne Bradstreet announcing what Elizabeth proves about the nature of women.
The poem, titled In Honor of That High and Mighty Princess Queen of Happy Memory, was published in 1650, 47 years after Elizabeth's death, but her presence was still strong. Bradstreet wrote,
"Now say, have women worth, or have they none? Or had they some but with our queen is gone? Nay, masculines, you have thus taxed us long, but she, though dead, will vindicate our wrong. Let such as say our sex is void of reason, no, 'tis a slander now, but once was treason."
Kind of witty and pithy.
As a Victorianist, I noticed that nobody mentioned Queen Victoria, although her name is on our lips all the time.
Adrian Munich is professor of English and Women's Studies at the State University of New York, Stony Brook, and is author of the book, Queen Victoria's Secrets.
And this is in contrast to Queen Elizabeth I. No respectable Elizabethan scholar, I think, can go very long without thinking about the monarch that named her age and thinking about the kinds of influences she had. Whereas Queen Victoria, for extremely interesting reasons after I thought about it, managed to be invisible in plain view.
Victoria ruled for 64 years, from 1839 to 1901, and saw people through their millennial moment.
I think that her presence is a testimony to the imaginative or poetic life of her subjects. One finds her in, of course, literature as an influence, and not as an explicit influence. That is, we don't have the character of Queen Victoria in these works. But the position that she held in her age as an anomaly, as a woman who was a queen at the top of the social scale at a time when women were supposed to be invisible in the private sphere, in their homes, created a kind of interesting imaginative conflict in which she had to manage to be there and not to be too threatening.
Charles Dickens admired her. Rudyard Kipling wrote a poem of thanksgiving for her survival when one of the 7 assassination attempts on her life failed. We find images of willful and excessive queens in Lewis Carroll's Alice books, and portrayals of women tamed by love and marriage in Gilbert and Sullivan operettas. In short, Victoria was a queen who could be many things to many people, and could also fit in with whatever people needed to imagine.
We charge you, ye queens, victorious. We yielded once with humble mien, because with all our faults we love the Queen.
Yes, yes, with all their faults they love the Queen. Yes, yes, with all their faults they love the Queen.
In Gilbert and Sullivan, I think you find her in a stock character, the dame figure, where she's always hungry for love and always pursuing people who are retreating as she pursues them. And the whole culture is disordered until somebody a victim, marries her and silences her. This is quite similar in some ways to Queen Victoria's marriage, famous marriage to Prince Albert. She was a willful and tempestuous young woman with a great temper, and the problem was, if it should be a problem, particularly in Victorian times, was to tame her. And this one version of the story of the love story of Albert and Victoria is her being tamed by love.
In Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado, Catashaw accepts a marriage proposal with the song "There is Beauty in the Bellow of the Blast," which conveys that sense of chaotic temper and elemental power at a time when women were supposed to be silent and subservient.
There is beauty in the bellow of the blast. There is grandeur in the growling of the gale. There is eloquent according when the lion is roaring and the tiger is the lashing of his tail.
I think this is why you have these kind of monstrous queen-like figures who threaten to envelop you, because she was so definite in her opinions, even though they changed and contradicted each other all the time. So she has this kind of explosive temper, and she's always trying to curb it.
Victoria was also portrayed in the broadside ballads sold on the street corners of London. One idea raised in these ballads was the notion that Queen Victoria could not be proposed to in marriage, but could only propose to her chosen one. Printed up as words without music, ordinarily they would be sung to a popular melody. Here's part of the lyric.
Since the queen did herself for a husband propose, the ladies will all do the same, I suppose. Their days of subserviency now will be past, for all will speak first, as they always did last.
And this created some great upheavals in the idea of what would be proper gender arrangements. So there were these street ballads about who was going to wear the breeches and who was going to be the ruler. And one of the street ballads imagines Victoria leaping out of her honeymoon bed into her husband's pants, deaf to his ineffectual protests.
She's all my lazen painted her. She's lovely. She is rich. But they tell me when I marry her that she will wear the breech.
The idea that she was more powerful as a woman queen than any male king could be was expressed in some of the ballads and was also an undercurrent of the culture in general.
She disturbs the natural order. And different from Queen Elizabeth I, because Queen Elizabeth I made a great deal out of her being the Virgin Queen, but Queen Victoria passed through all of the conventional roles of a woman.
At the time of her Golden Jubilee, Victoria influenced a popular 1887 adventure novel, She by H. Rider Haggard, a book that has also been brought to the screen.
She is a character who in the novel is called She Who Must Be Obeyed, always in italics. And she has survived what she calls the change that ye call death for 2,000 years in order to wait and to constantly mourn the death of her beloved. I think that this is an exaggerated, hyperbolic picture of Queen Victoria.
The contemporary film, Mrs. Brown, deals with the relationship between Victoria and her Scottish servant, John Brown, after the death of Prince Albert.
What is so interesting about this film, which was quite popular, and Judi Dench received a great, great deal of admiration for this and was nominated for an Academy Award for this role, was that it is so respectful. It still presents this elderly queen who is in eternal mourning. Most people think that the queen at the beginning of the film is in her 60s, when in fact she was in her early 40s. She was 42 when Prince Albert died. There was an opportunity to present a much more amorous queen, and for mysterious reasons, I guess, for reasons perhaps that we still have to preserve this idea of the elderly queen. They chose not to do that. But there was no question this was a very erotically charged relationship.
Together, Elizabeth and Victoria ruled England for 134 years. Maureen Quilligan.
Well, Elizabeth I and Victoria, Queen Victoria, seem to be, when you first glance at them, absolutely opposite. I mean, of course, they're both queens and they both ruled a long time. But Elizabeth is known for her virginity, and it's fair to say that Queen Victoria was known for her fecundity. After all, she spawned all the rulers of Europe throughout the late 19th and early 20th century. But I think that together they do tend to suggest that if you play by the rules, so to speak, and if the rules allow women to come to positions of power, in fact, they do very well indeed.
Catherine Eiseman Moss.
I think these two queens kind of bracket England's period of being a great power. In Elizabeth's time, England is just coming into its own as a major European power. And her ability to keep England out of continental conflicts means that the ingenuity of its people can be turned to all kinds of other useful and interesting activities. I think the same thing sort of happens during Victoria's reign.
Adrian Munich.
Well, Elizabeth I had more actual power, and in retrospect, the Victorians saw her as autocratic. But of course, also, she had a much smaller and more manageable realm. But they both had such a kind of authority over their times and was able to reflect it in various ways that I think in that way they're comparable. And the Victorians, in fact, liked to compare themselves to the great age of Elizabeth in their explorations, in their imperialist ambitions. The imperial mother became the counterpart to the great Virgin Queen.
This edition of What's the Word? Elizabeth and Victoria was written, produced, and narrated by Sally Plaxen. Technical director, Duke Marcos. Production coordinator, Lee Morgan. Special thanks to Darren DePaul, Deborah DePaul, Columbia University Press, and the University of Chicago Press. For a list of works mentioned on this program, please write the Modern Language Association of America, 26 Broadway, 3rd floor, New York, New York, 10004, and ask for a copy of the list for program number 38. That's the Modern Language Association of America, 26 Broadway, 3rd floor, New York, New York, 10004. Or call 646-576-5102. That's 646-576-5102. To listen to other programs in the series, visit our website, www.mla.org. You can contact us by email at wtwradio@pacbell.net. That's wtwradio@pacbell.net. Join us next time on What's the Word?